This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Jay Bean, serial entrepreneur and founder of Freshlime. You may not have heard of Freshlime yet, but if Jay's track record is any indication, it's about to become one of Utah's fastest-growing companies. Why do I say that? Because he's done it before. Twice, actually. Shortly after graduating from Weber State University, Jay founded his first company, Aha.com, an online marketing firm. In just 4 short years, he grew it to $35 million a year in sales, at which point he sold it for just under $15 million. For an encore, Jay started Orange Soda, another online marketing platform. He sold that company in 2012 for almost $28 million. Stay with us to hear more about Jay's exciting journey and his latest company, Freshlime. Jay, welcome to The Bottom Line.
Hey, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So I want to talk about your current startup, Freshlime. But as we talked just before we started recording, I want to kind of go back to the beginning and talk about some of your other ventures. And the company most people here have likely heard of is Orange Soda. Tell us what Orange Soda did and why that became the big success it was.
Orange Soda was really kind of in this transformational space where small businesses started going from really yellow page advertising and putting their dollars online. And a lot of times they didn't know where to go or to get how to get started. And so these are dentists, doctors, plumbers, attorneys, all kind of the traditional advertisers and traditional business that we deal with every day. And so Orange Soda was really kind of a platform to help them transition from kind of that old medium into kind of online.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the yellow pages, because in my mind, really what Orange Soda did is a local, what I call local SEO search engine optimization. But I'm glad you brought up the yellow pages, because Utah has a history in the yellow page, at least the online version of it. John Richards was involved. I think his company, yellowpages.com, YP.com?
No, it wasn't YP. It was something. It was one of the early yellow pages, but it basically became part of InfoSpace in maybe like 98 or 99, something like that.
Okay. And was any of his work, was that, did you look at that and say, hey, we're going to do a derivative of this and that's what Orange Soda was, or was it kind of a fresh idea?
It was really a fresh idea. In fact, I consulted with John when we were first starting Freshlime, and kind of our whole concept, he told me it wouldn't work.
Freshlime or Orange Soda?
I mean, sorry, with Orange Soda. I apologize. With Orange Soda, I consulted with John, and he said it wasn't going to work.
Which to John's credit, you know, I'm an investor as well. And there's a lot of ideas that we look at and say, I just don't get it. I hope you're wildly successful. I hope I'm wrong. So that's interesting. He knows the space really well. And yet he looked at your initial strategy and said, you know, you're going to meet with some resistance.
Yeah, and to his credit, he came back after a while and said, congratulations, because we did do what we said we were going to do. But it was really kind of this whole, the transformation, I mean, and kind of when he was in the space, it was a great time in those early days when people were first getting online and kind of advertising, but a lot happened between 98 or 99 and 2006 when we started Orange Soda. And that really, that transformation that was starting to happen, what we did wouldn't have been able to work in the year of 2000, but just because of the value of Yellow Pages had gone down so much, the value of online was really kind of taking its place, and that's why we're successful.
Which brings up a good point, right? Sometimes having that intimate knowledge of an industry can make it harder for you to see the next evolution of that industry. Take somebody from the outside, like yourself, to come in and say, we're going to do this dramatically different. And it's not surprising that the insiders say, well, that can't work. Because if they thought it would work, there would probably be a couple of them chasing that idea as well.
Then that's probably the case. And I think with small businesses, I mean, the cost of acquiring those customers is really kind of the prohibiting factor. And that's probably when John was pushing back. He's like, there's no way you're going to be able to go sell to these mom and pop shops around the country. And so, but the approach that we took with Orange Soda is we did have direct customers. But we actually went to the source. So we went and partnered with all the big Yellow Page companies, the big newspaper companies, and other small business aggregators. So we weren't always the one that was taking our product to the street. So we just looked at the market a little different. We used the vehicle that was already there. We're not trying to create our own vehicle. Yet we created solutions that they needed at the time. And so we were successful in acquiring a lot of customers over a short period of time.
Okay. And when you came up with the idea of orange soda, you talked to a bunch of people. Some saw it, some didn't. My understanding is you had one angel investor that wrote a $2.5 million check to get you going. But I don't know for sure. Is that accurate?
And that's not okay. Correct. So we had our initial angel funding was all Utah money, and it was 10 or 11 local angels.
So more of a traditional angel round.
Is more of a bigger. Traditional angel round. I did have one of those that ended up putting in about $800,000, but most of them were, other than me putting in money as well, most of them were kind of smaller, $25,000, $50,000 type of investors.
Okay. And at this point, I'd mentioned in the open, you had sold aha.com for just under $15 million. So you've got a nice success under your belt.
Yeah. And actually, aha, overall, I mean, our investors and our employees probably, the initial sell was $15 million plus stock in a company called Marchex. And so we basically became the foundation of
Marchex.
Which
went public months after.
Which went public less than a year after. And yep. So our investors and employees is probably closer to a $50 million exit,
nice.
Not
nice.
15. So.
Okay. So now you've got a nice success under your belt. You're starting Orange Soda. You're going out and talking to the angel community to raise money. How hard was that round to raise? Was it relatively easy because of your earlier success?
I don't think that raising money is ever super easy. Even with past successes, investors still want to see kind of what you're going to do, and they're still going to hold you to numbers and all these other things. Yet, I was actually living in Europe, so I moved to Europe right before I started Orange Soda. I wanted to be there with my family for a year, and so I was commuting back and forth.
It hard to raise money,
and so it made it a little bit more difficult. Right. But we had a good model, and we started selling pretty quickly. And that first year, we did $1.7 million in revenue, and so that helped. So we raised it in a couple of chunks, but that helped a lot.
Yeah, I didn't have the revenue numbers, but I knew in your first year you went from 4 employees to 65.
Yeah,
which is a big commitment. So obviously you were seeing a lot of traction right away. Why do you think the market, which is unusual, as you know, some it takes time to build up. The first year or two, or sometimes three or four, can be really getting the word out about your product, getting the early users, and earning the right to have that kind of growth. Why do you think you met with growth right from the get-go?
We had a lot of success with AHA in this small business marketplace selling advertising. And so we already understood the dynamics of small business. We already understood kind of what they were looking for in products. We knew that this was kind of the evolution that was taking place. AHA, we had 40,000 small business customers, and it was pay-per-click advertising and one of those early engines. And I think that we had so many learnings, and I was fortunate enough at the time, Marchex decided to close the Utah office. And so 20 of my first employees actually came from, they had just worked for me in a year before. And so we had all this institutional knowledge we took in from the beginning. And so that enabled us to scale from kind of really at startup to 1.7. The next year we did 8.9 million. And so scale pretty quickly, but it's because
of the
people.
So the next year being 2007, 2008?
2008.
So which was a tough time. You're dealing with small businesses, and we're about to enter financial Armageddon.
Yep.
What was that like? Were you guys still growing like crazy, or did you feel the full effect of the financial crisis?
I think we definitely felt the effect of it, but at the same time, advertisers still need to go out there and get their name out there, and they still need leads. They still need customers coming in. And so at the time, when you have a traditional form of advertising that is not working, it's not as effective as it used to be, and advertisers or small businesses still need to get customers. And so so even in 2008, we did like the $8.9 million in revenue. The next year, it slowed down a little bit. We did 14.5. The next year, we did 19.5. And so we were able to still grow through that. And it was partly because of our model. And it was partly because we went out and partnered with the guys who already had the customers. And so if you're a Yellow Page company and a customer is buying print and they want to cut that print, if you have a digital product that you can move them over to and they're happy with that, then part of that revenue can transition over. And so that was partly the reason that we continue to grow even while other
markets
were going.
Let me put this in context for the audience. So 2008, 2009, we all remember it. I work in the financial markets. Google, their stock value was cut in half during the 2008, I think a little bit more than half. And even their revenue growth slowed. I'm not saying that they had negative growth, but their growth trajectory definitely felt it. And here's little orange soda in Salt Lake City, Utah, and you guys are just taking off. Do you think that's because of the expansion of your sales team? Did you see your revenue per customer go down as people kind of were more cautious on their advertised spending?
I don't know that. I don't think that revenue per customer went down among kind of the small business advertisers. We also had a number of large, I mean, like a Remax, for example, where we're doing kind of the regional advertising, and maybe some of those budgets went down, but from the small advertiser, I think it stayed pretty steady during that time. And personally, I mean, I felt the effects. Actually, I used to own some sunglass stores, and in 2008, I started them in 2005. I had three stores here in Utah. It was called Sunglasses Only, and
you weren't busy enough between living in your Europe, selling your company to a firm that's going public 12 months after you sold to them, and starting Orange Soda, you decided you wanted to get into the sunglass retail business?
Do you know, it was a project. And actually, for the first few years, it was fun. It was retail. It was something totally different. But in 2008, we went from selling $100,000 a month in sunglasses to 30. And so that business actually, we had to close it. It was a big cost. But I mean, so I felt those effects. At the same time, I had this online business that was growing. And so I know from an entrepreneur standpoint, I mean, I know what it's like to have to kind of stress through closing something as well. But at the same time, so maybe I'm a better online guy than I am a retail guy. But anyway, so I did feel those full effects, and I did see the difference in the economy.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jay Bean, founder and CEO of Fresh Lime Orange Soda, and we just found out also Sunglasses Only, which is you can no longer shop there. But let's keep talking about Orange Soda. 2008, so you continue to grow through 2008. You also closed an investment round. My understanding is you closed about $5 million at that period of time. When in 2008 did you close that round?
We closed that round in August of that year.
So things are starting to get pretty scary. I mean, Lehman Brothers went under. It was either September or at the latest October.
Yeah.
We're hearing, I mean, just really scary headline stories. I think Congress had initially not passed TARP. The president of the United States, back then, President Bush, got on television and said, you need to contact your congressman or woman, because if they don't pass this, financial Armageddon is in front. I mean, I could not believe that I was actually seeing this. I mean, it was really a very scary thing for the president of the United States to be talking about. During that scary period of time, you were able to raise $5 million. Did your investors were there people that were like, you know what, Jay, I really like what you're doing, but I need to save my cash reserves. Did you feel that in the investment round at all?
Do you know, we did. We actually had term sheets from traditional VCs. We ended up taking strategic money. It was from Network Solutions. They were already a partner of ours. They liked our business. In fact, they originally approached us about buying the business, and we had this great growth going on. And so obviously that whole conversation started earlier in the year. I mean, we ended up closing that round later in the year, but the conversations really started in March when we didn't have that kind of financial outlook. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think there was probably some hesitation, but at the same time, these businesses need to grow. And we had a model that was working. It was showing value for small business advertisers. The ROI on their investment dollars was good. And small businesses still need to grow, even in a downturn.
And the nice thing about what you're doing at Orange Soda is all trackable.
It's all trackable,
100%. So a small business can say, okay, I invested $500 last month, and here's the leads that I got, and they can do the math and figure out, which I think helps you quite a bit, right? Because you're cutting back on all the things that you don't have clarity on. And the things that are working, boy, if you're going to deploy any money, you're gonna deploy it in the things that are working. And in your case, they knew. The challenge with advertising oftentimes, you don't know what's working and what's not. And the nice thing about the online world is you do. So you just said network was
Network Solutions.
Network Solutions led that round. They also offered to buy your company, which is a tough decision. So you had a success a couple years earlier. You had some early investors. Now Network Solutions says, "Hey, we like what you're doing. We'd like to buy you." That must have been a tough decision. You probably had some advisors, some investors that were saying, "Yes, let's sell."
Yeah, and it was early on. I mean, we were at the time when they first approached us, we were 16 or 17 months old, and we were growing. I mean, we were doing what we wanted to do, and I think it's always a hard decision. I mean, if I were to go back, I may have made a different decision, but you can't look at it that way. I mean, I think at the time we made the best decision possible for us as a company. We saw the outlook, kind of the marketplace. We knew, I mean, there's billions of dollars are being spent in traditional forms of advertising at the time, and we know that this shift is going on.
You could have been the next Yelp, right? I mean, a competitor, a company that it's different. I mean, it's different. More focused on restaurants and stuff like that. But you were going after the same, helping local merchants connect with local consumers. And that's still a piece of the puzzle that I would argue is largely unsolved, today.
Oh, I agree with you. It is largely unsolved. And I think kind of our whole approach, rather than building our own brands, I mean, if you look at kind of my track record, everything that I've done from AHA to Orange Soda and now to Fresh Lime, it's all helping that small business owner build and maintain
brand.
Their own brand versus building and maintaining my brand. And when we get into talking about Fresh Lime, it's exactly the same way. There's lots of great marketplaces today in the home services space, just like Yelp and others are kind of marketplaces, and they want to bring all that traffic through their portal because that's how they make money.
Yeah.
Everything I do is really kind of focused on building that one-on-one relationship between a small business owner and their customers.
Yeah. Well, let's keep going, but I want to go back to your comment. If you had to do it over, maybe you would have sold it to Network Solutions. Why do you say that?
Well, from a financial standpoint, it would have been a lot better for me. And I, obviously, I think I like the learnings and the things that we went through. I mean, it was painful. I mean, it's always when you're growing a business. And so we were growing really rapidly and going from from an employee standpoint as well. But obviously, some of the financial impact did. We had too many employees. We got to a point where we were not growing quite as fast as we were before. We still had nice growth year after year, but we're always planning ahead. So there was a time where we ended up having 20 more employees than we need to, and I've never had to let employees go. But sometime in 2009, we had to trim back somewhat. And so those painful areas, if I would have sold...
Which is more common than not. Most startup companies go through a period of time where they have to lay off some of their team, oftentimes a lot of their teams. Ben Horowitz is a very well-known venture capitalist, Andreessen Horowitz.
Yep.
He wrote a very good book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. Have you read that book?
I've not read it.
You are going to love it. I will gift it to you on Audible. I'm a big Audible fan. But he talks about the process of building a company called Opsware. I believe it was Opsware. And ultimately sold it for $1.6 billion to HP, so good success.
Yeah.
But he had to lay off, if not once, I believe twice, 90% of his team.
Wow.
Being a CEO is tough. I mean, the difficult parts of your journey. What were some of the more difficult parts? So you had to lay off 20 employees.
Yeah, I think laying off employees, I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things, because people are trusting in your vision. They're trusting in what you're building. And for me, employees and kind of their families, and making sure that I've never missed a payroll. I mean, that's one of the unique things about most startups at some point miss payroll. But
you can miss payroll, but don't ever miss paying payroll taxes.
Exactly. And so, but I think those are the hard times when you're trying to make those decisions and people are trusting in you and they have families to take care of as well. And especially when the economy is a little poor, that's not nobody wants to be laid off during those types of times. And so, but it's always a struggle. I mean, trying to figure out what model's going to work and what the value proposition for the customer is. And people are trusting that you're going to figure it out. And I think those are always, when you look back, I think that they're good times, because that's when you grow the most. But when you're going through some of those times, it's very painful.
Yeah, no, I think it's can be done properly. It can be one of the strongest culture building situations, right? It's easy to stay on board when the company's growing 50% year over year. But you find out who's really dedicated to that vision and who really believes in the company when that slows. And then you're like, okay, guys, what are we going to do to get back on that growth trajectory? So ultimately, you ended up selling Orange Soda to, I believe it's called the Deluxe Corporation, which most listeners here may not have heard of. But if you look at the physical checks that you write to pay bills every now and then, that's what they're really famous for, right, is paper checks that consumers and businesses use to pay bills.
Absolutely. So Deluxe is a 98 or 99-year-old company now, and they print the vast majority of checks in North America. They actually have a printing facility here in Salt Lake out by the airport. But
so how did they come to the table? I mean, they're not a natural acquirer for a company like Orange Soda. Would you agree, or is there a piece of their business I don't understand?
Typically, it would not make sense. But Deluxe Corporation and the current CEO a number of years ago decided that for whatever reason, that they wanted to transform their business and offer other small business services. That
I bet I can guess why they're interested in transforming their business. I mean, 20 years from now, are we going to be writing physical checks? Maybe not.
I don't want to say that, but
I can, you can. Yeah. It's okay.
And so, I mean, but it makes sense. I mean, they have 4.5 million small business customers, and these customers are out buying online advertising. They have websites. They're doing social. They're doing all these other aspects. And so a number of years ago, Deluxe decided that they're going to build out this small business services. And so they've acquired a number of companies along the way, hosting companies, email marketing companies, so on and so forth. And so Orange Soda was really a natural fit to help kind of bring all of those product sets together. So if you're selling them a domain and you're selling them a website, online marketing is going to be a natural fit along with email marketing and other things. And so it really makes sense.
I can see that. They've got the, as you said, they've got the relationship with small and mid-sized businesses.
Yeah.
How can they leverage that into a new growth business? So you sell it to Deluxe. My notes here say $28 million.
Yep.
So one day you sell it, and my understanding is you stayed with the company for a while, and the next day now you're working for a 99-year-old check publisher. That's a big transition for a high-tech entrepreneur. What was that like?
I mean, it was actually interesting for me, just because my role actually moved over to a Deluxe role immediately. So within their small business division, I was their chief strategy officer. And so they had acquired all of these companies, but they were not necessarily working together. They had different backgrounds. They didn't have the same culture. They didn't have the same core values.
I'm sure it was very different.
It was very different. And so my whole role was, how do we piece all these things together? How do we get all of our employees in 15 different locations around the globe kind of working together towards common vision, mission, and goals? And so I love culture. I mean, I think with both AHA and Orange Soda, we've built companies here in Utah that have very unique cultures. People like what they do. They love what they're working. They love who they're working with. And so I had a really cool experience at Deluxe where I was taking, within our division, I was taking employees in Canada and Ukraine and throughout the United States and London and other areas and trying to get them moving towards being part of one team and having common goals and objectives that we wanted to accomplish. And so,
which is hard enough with a 99-year-old company, even more. I didn't realize that they had the global presence that you just shared. So you've got folks that come from a different culture because of their industry, but also you're dealing with many different country cultures and citizenship culture. What were a couple things that you found that worked?
One is actually communication. I mean, I think it's really important. And a lot of companies, a lot of startup companies, I mean, they're very open about, very transparent with their employees about here's where we are, here's what our objectives are for the quarter, and being very transparent about kind of the financial situation, the growth statistics, so on and so forth. I think large companies, especially public companies, aren't able to share that type of data. And so trying to bring, and because we're just a smaller group, trying to bring some transparency into that group and to get people believing and working together. I mean, if you have, it doesn't matter if you have an office here and an office in California, if they have different goals and objectives and they may place blame or whatever. And so if you can get them working as part of one team and that was kind of one of the big objectives that we had.
That's the goal. The challenge is how do you get there? We all have that goal. The challenge is how to get there. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Jay Bean, founder and CEO of Orange Soda and Fresh Lime. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. Today we're talking with Jay Bean, founder and CEO of Orange Soda and more recently Fresh Lime. So you sold Orange Soda to Deluxe, so that kind of put a bow on that. Let's if we can, go back before we go forward and talk about what you did after graduating from Weber State University. You went to go work for a company called Mindshare, and from there you launched a company called AHA.com. Grew very quickly, and in 4 or 5 years you sold it to a company that used you really as the foundation for them to go public, a firm called Marchex. What was the original idea for AHA.com? And why did you see a need for that?
Do you know, I was actually an economics major. I moved to Kansas City. Actually, I worked for Temp Reps for Allen Hall in 92.
Market Star.
It was before they changed the name to Market Star. And so anyway, I moved out to Kansas City, and every day I was out talking to computer people trying to sell them and try to help them promote kind of software products.
So let me take a step back. I didn't know it used to be called Temp Help.
Temp Reps.
Temp Reps. Before that, after that, it was the name was changed to Market Star. Yep. And they would help companies like HP and Apple sell to small to medium business. They would go to HP and say, look, you're great at the Fortune 500 contracts, not so good at the small to medium sized business. They would contract with Alan Hall's company to do that channel. So you started off with them.
Yeah, I started off with them. I was actually a rep. I would go out and go to computer stores. At the time, there was CompUSA and Computer City and obviously the Staples and Office Maxes and Office Depots and Best Buys. Anyway, I'd go in and train those employees on those different products on a daily basis. I did that for a couple of years. Then I went and worked for a competitor, which was called Mindshare Associates. And working for Mindshare, I ended up moving back to Utah to manage some of these programs where reps were at out kind of promoting products around the country. And so that's what kind of brought me back to Utah.
So you're an economic – first off, I think having a sales background is really important in all types of things later in life. It tends to be a difficult job, especially earlier in your career, kind of the entry-level type positions. So you've got a degree in economics. What drew you towards sales?
It didn't seem like a sales job. I mean, I think kind of Alan Hall's whole premise early on was really, we were marketers. We weren't going and getting a signature. We weren't necessarily selling the end product. We were really going out and training and marketing and getting other, these employees in these stores excited about a new mouse or the software product or whatever it was, and getting them to kind of promote it and push it a little bit more. And so it wasn't a hard salesy job. It was really kind of more of a marketing type of a job.
Okay. And I'm a big fan of Alan Hall. The opportunity to be mentored by Alan and his team early in your career is just invaluable. He's a, as you know, he's a venture capitalist now with Mercado Partners.
Yep.
Ross and I here at the studio are hoping to get him and or Greg Warnock in here sometime soon as a guest. But so you were with Mindshare. You got comfortable with the whole idea of marketing. You had relationships with small to mid-sized businesses. And how did you make the leap from that to aha.com?
So I need to say I didn't finish my degree actually when I went to work for Alan Hall. I don't know why it says it on there that I did. So I was studying economics. I planned to go out and do that for a summer and ended up meeting my wife out in Kansas City while I was out there. And so one of these days I actually need to go back and finish my degree. So I just wanted to kind of
that's probably state my that. Mistake on the research. So sorry.
So anyway, I apologize there. So anyway, I was back in Utah. I grew up in Eastern Idaho, but every day I was working online, and I mean, kind of the internet was really kind of taking off. And one day, just a buddy of mine and I at lunch were like, "This would be really cool if we could go help small businesses kind of get online." And it was really initially we're thinking about just giving them websites and building them websites, and so that's really where it started. And I can't remember the first website we built. It was actually for a temp agency in Salt Lake. But we found once we build a website, now what? And so that was really kind of the foundation of AHA was.
And this was back in 99, this early 2000.
This is
right?
This is actually in 1999.
Okay. So the internet's just taking off. Many of your customers never had a website before. This is their first website.
Oh, this would be their first website. And really kind of the only options to advertise were to go to like AltaVista or Excite
Google
or Yahoo.
Google didn't exist at that point.
Google didn't even exist at that point. But they would have to go and buy untargeted banner advertising, $3,000 or $4,000 a month. And for a local business in Salt Lake, that didn't make sense, right? And so that was kind of the foundation of AHA was, hey, there's these local small businesses. They need to advertise to local consumers. Having untargeted banner advertising on Yahoo is not going to give them any value. And so that was kind of the foundation of AHA was, hey, we're going to be two things. We decided we're going to be a family-friendly search engine, and we were going to allow small business advertisers to get on our search engine and kind of promote themselves for low cost, like $25 a month. And that's where it was born.
So I miss this. You guys were actually back in the day a search engine.
We were. AHA was a...
So you'd go to Yahoo to do a search, or you could go to aha.com to do a search.
So one of our first partners was KSL, and so we powered... If you went to KSL back then, and the search bar that they had was actually our search bar. And so AHA, throughout our history, we always had distribution partners, and so we grew it from no traffic back in 99 to by the time we were acquired by MarchX, we were doing probably 100 million queries a day.
Now, I know people that when Google launched said, you know, the world doesn't need a better search engine. And this is Google, right?
Yep.
Clearly, they were wrong. Did you have a lot of people tell you that when you said, I'm going to create a search engine to help local merchants connect to local consumers?
Probably. I was so young, though, I didn't know what I was getting into, for one.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily have a network to go out and raise money. We were just kind of nickel and diming this thing. And I was living in Roy at the time. Our first office was in downtown Ogden. We spent, I think, $250 a month for 800 square feet of space. And so you can imagine how nice it was. But we really didn't know what we were getting into. And so if there was naysayers and said, you can't do this, we would have probably just blown them off.
And rightfully so, right? I mean, we talked before the interview started. I mean, that's the challenge, is you're going to have a lot of people that say this idea can't work. And you need to listen to that and see, you know, make sure you understand what the concern is. But if every time somebody told an entrepreneur their idea is not going to work, if they quit, we wouldn't have Apple computers, we wouldn't have Amazon.com, we certainly wouldn't have Airbnb.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Can you think of a worst idea that, I mean, clearly Airbnb has been successful. I say this in jest, but than renting rooms in your home to strangers. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons that idea should not have worked, and yet it's one of the fastest growing companies in the history of the world. I mean, wildly successful. So stick with your idea if you believe in it. So despite the fact that you were a little naive, didn't have money, eventually you did raise money. My understanding is you raised about $3.5 million. How early in the company's history did you do that, and how did you make that happen?
So we raised about $500,000, mostly from family and friends and people that we knew in those early days in 1999. In 2000, we actually moved the company to Utah County. We raised $1.7 million. But right after that, if you remember 2000, we talk about 1998.
The internet bubble burst.
The internet bubble burst. And a lot of our shareholders are like, hey, maybe this is not the best thing. And so we ended up giving most of that money back to shareholders, laid off all of our employees. AHA was actually a company with 9 lives. But our employees still wanted to, this is like in April of 2000, our employees still wanted to kind of build this thing. And so we had, I don't know, out of our 35 or 40 employees, maybe 25 of them showed up for work right after we laid them off the next Monday and kept working.
That must have felt great for you as a founder and CEO to see that level of dedication.
It was. And we had a great team. And so I basically ended up with 2 business partners, Chris Stevens and Paul Brockbank. And we went out and raised $200,000 and kept the company going. And AHA was first acquired by MyFamily.com in November of 2000. And then we ended up buying ourselves back and sucking it back out 6 months later. And by that point, we were actually profitable and then kind of...
And you were glad you did, because on the 9th life of AHA.com, you sold it for just under $13.5 million to a company called Marchex, which did something really unusual with your company. They really weren't a company. They bought your company to get a foundation with the idea of going public.
Absolutely. And so the founders of Marchex, they had a previous company called GoToNet. And GoToNet was basically built the same way. They went out and acquired something as the foundation, acquired a bunch of other companies, and that company ended up merging with InfoSpace in the year of 2000. And so Russ Horowitz and his...
And had some challenges when the dot-com bubble burst.
Well, they did.
I want to choose my words carefully. The Seattle Times wrote an article about it and said, you know, that, hey, there were managers in the company that were selling and potentially new things weren't going well. But so InfoSpace kind of had an ugly ending to it. And then Marchex comes to you and says, hey, we want to buy your company. Did they share with you the game plan was to roll it up and go public?
Absolutely. We knew the game plan. And we'd had a couple of other companies that had tried to acquire us, and they just weren't the right fit. And but when the team from Marchex came, they had a great track record. If you really looked at their history, those guys built a great company in the past.
With GoToNet.
Yep. They had a lot of the early paper. A lot of the early search engines were part of that GoToNet company. And so they had a good game plan, and they did exactly what they said they were going to do. I mean, 13 or 14 months after they acquired us, about a year after they acquired another company, and then 2 months later went public.
It was perfect timing for you guys, because they bought you guys in 2003.
Yeah.
They went public in 2004, right when Google was doing all the PR work for them, because Google went public in 2004 as well. AHA.com, being a search engine as well, kind of goes out on their coattails also. They priced it. What was it? At $6.50. Right after the IPO, it hits $9 a share. It ultimately hit a peak of $25 a share. But to this day, if you look at Marchex stock price, it hovers below the IPO price. I mean, it's not a penny stock. It's a little under half the IPO price. It's $4 a share. Why do you think Marchex didn't take off with with their idea of aha.com, and I believe they rolled up a couple other players in your space as well.
Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of great assets. I mean, one of the things that they did, and I can't remember, it's probably 2005, they bought a large domain portfolio, and they raised a lot of money in order to do that. So they have, I mean, they're very much still a great player in the local space. They have and they continue to transform their business. They're probably one of the biggest call tracking providers on the internet today. As why I'm not sure why their stock has not done well. I mean, they have a lot of good value there and the kind of the services they offer. And they've transformed a lot over time. I mean, pay-per-click search, or kind of the traditional search that they started with, is not a big piece of their business today. But they're, as mobile and other things kind of transform in this marketplace, I mean, they're really kind of one of those players that's well positioned to take advantage of kind of the next pieces that are coming along.
But you guys were really happy you had bought the company back from myfamily.com. That ended up being a nice exit for you and the investors that participated.
Absolutely.
In that. Great. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Jay Bean, founder and CEO of Orange Soda, aha.com, and more recently, Fresh Lime. Welcome back to The Bottom Line at KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Jay Bean, founder and CEO of Orange Soda, aha.com, and just recently, Fresh Lime. So let's talk about what you're doing now. You've been very gracious with your time, kind of telling us about your journey and what you're excited about now and what you're building now as a company called Fresh Lime. What does Fresh Lime do?
It's not a citrus company. I don't know why I've gotten on this theme. No, Fresh Lime is actually, well, I've spent the last 15 years really helping small businesses, sending them traffic, sending them leads, sending them customers. But I've really now been on the other side where I'm helping them take those customers and creating recurring revenue and recurring value out of those customers. And so Fresh Lime is essentially a marketing automation company. And so we're helping small businesses that really kind of survive off of filling a daily schedule and making sure that they're filling that schedule with the most efficient customers possible. And so that may be an HVAC guy or landscaper or a window cleaner. It could also mean, someone that's doing taxes or cutting hair or other things. But really kind of our whole philosophy is around taking their existing customer base and helping them engage with those customers on a more regular basis. And this is not sending out spammy newsletters and things like that. It's really targeting customers when they're most likely to buy those services again.
And what do you mean by that, targeting them when they're most likely to buy those services?
So an example, I mean, there's 160 million homes in North America, and all of those have heating units. A lot of them have air conditioner units, and things like that need to be serviced on a more regular basis. Otherwise, and I don't know if you've ever had an air conditioner unit go out, but they're not cheap to replace. And if people would do more regular maintenance on things like that.
You're making me nervous. It's been probably 4 or 5 years since I've done regular maintenance on my air conditioning unit. Am I supposed to be doing it more often?
You should actually have someone come and service it once a year just to make sure that it's well maintained. And so so now when spring's coming along, then for the HVAC guy, if he were engaging with his customer saying spring's coming along and these are the 5 reasons you should have your air conditioner service before summertime, maybe your Freon's getting low or whatever the case might be, for a few dollars, you can have him come out and service that. And so it's just like the dentist. I mean, if you think about, we all know who our dentist is. And our dentist engages with us every 6 months. They want us to come back. And it's really for that maintenance piece. But they do other work when we're there.
You know,
there.
It's funny you mentioned dentists because that was not the case 7 years ago.
It wasn't.
Right? Yeah. And there are a couple Utah, for whatever reason, Utah companies love the dental industry.
They do.
There are a couple Utah companies that have targeted the dental industry and said, here's how you can stay in front of your customers to make sure they're coming back for regular cleanings. And so clearly, industries can evolve because you're exactly right, boy. a month before my 6 month appointment, I get a reminder a week before. Yep. I get a text 4 hours before my cleaning's due. Hey, just want to make sure, because no-shows are a real problem for the dental industry. Oh. So is your idea to kind of bring that, when you say marketing automation, is that what you're talking about, and to bring it to the folks that maybe do the lawn care and like all the other service, maybe my car mechanic, hey, you haven't, it's time to get your oil changed.
Exactly. So any of those service-based industries, they don't do a good job engaging with customers. They don't typically follow up very well, but it's all the things that the dentist is doing today to keep customers coming back. I mean, they're going to follow up and say, thanks for coming today. When was the last time someone came and cleaned your windows or cleaned your carpets and you got even an email back from them saying, hey, thanks for getting your carpets cleaned today. If there's anything else we can do, let us know. Or, hey, how did we do today? Can you leave us a review? Traditionally, if you go out and look, a lot of these service industries they don't have very many reviews online. I mean, if you go to Google, where 99% of the traffic is, not 99%, but I mean, it's a vast majority of the traffic, these guys don't have any reviews. Yet, you'll go to Angie's List or Home Advisor, and they have 40.
Or even, you know, you go to an Apple store.
Yeah.
And you get 100 yards outside of the Apple store. In my case, my iPhone goes off and says, how'd we do?
How'd we do today?
And it's a company called Medallia out of the Bay Area, backed by Sequoia. It's a $100 million investment. It's the largest single investment Sequoia made, right? Very powerful tool for Fortune 500 companies to better understand the experience that their customers are getting. But you're exactly right. You know, when somebody comes to clean your windows or you take your car in to get the oil changed or get some maintenance done, nobody asks you how you're doing. And if it's valuable to the Fortune 500 company, it's probably even more valuable in a local community.
It is. I mean, and I think as you look at especially these service industries, it's expensive acquiring a new customer, yet they're keeping their existing customer bases on a yellow notebook, or maybe it's an order form, and the little order forms are stacking up over in the corner. How do you engage with a customer that way? The rest of our economy is digitizing their customer bases, and they're doing more to engage with us and try to get us to come back. I mean, there's been a number of studies that have done. I mean, our houses in America are aging. I mean, I think 80% of houses are now over 35 or 40 years old. The average homeowner is going to spend $4,000 a year on maintaining their house. And we've delayed a lot of that because of 2008 and 2009, 2010. Yet service providers are not necessarily engaging those customers to get back in there. And so the dentist's lifetime value of his customers is super, super high. It's probably 20 times or 30 times what an HVAC guy would be. But HVAC guy really could come into your house and do service twice a year, once in the fall for your heater and once in the spring. And I'm just using HVAC as an example. Like my wife wants her windows cleaned a few times a year, and yet I have to remember who I used last time. I have to go find their number again. If that guy would just engage with me or engage with my wife through the mobile phone or through an email and saying, I'm going to be in your neighborhood next Tuesday. I have 3 slots open. Do you want one of them? A simple click and be done with it. I don't have to pick up the phone 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And it's not even, there's a convenience factor there for both the consumer and for the merchant, but merchants, average merchant, when I talk about merchant, I mean, an average service provider has 5 appointments a day, 5 days a week, and he's spending 5 to 10 minutes on the phone with each one of those customers, actually writing down their address and getting their information again, rather than taking 30 seconds and having it in a palm of his hand in an app. And that's what Fresh Lime has really created, is those simple tools to help him keep track of his customers. At the same time, on the back end, we're doing that heavy lifting. We're saying, okay, this is going to be the best time to engage this customer in order to get them to use your service again.
So a lot of these tools exist. My sense is they're not simple enough and efficient enough in one package. For instance, if you want to do market automation right down in Provo, David Elkington, who's been a guest on this show, InsideSales.com, yep, They'd love to talk to you. If you want to do a survey of your customers right down in Provo, Qualtrics,
yep,
Ryan Smith would love to chat with you. I mentioned Medallia, that's doing surveys. Salam Basan. Help me out with his company's name. I know it ends in MX, but I forget the beginning of it.
Well, it's just MX now, isn't it?
Is it just MX?
Yeah,
okay.
So.
You know, he'd love to work with you. But the challenge is these are probably fairly high learning curve and targeting maybe a bigger company than what you're targeting.
Yeah, and I think most SaaS solutions, there's a lot of great SaaS solutions out there, but there is a little bit of a learning curve. Someone has to spend X hours every week kind of maintaining and updating that. And and one of the things I've learned over the last 15 years working with small business owners, they're really good at what they do. So they're really good at doing taxes. They're really good at fixing air conditioners, but they're not necessarily that great at marketing. I mean, the whole concept of marketing scares them. And so that's why there's still billions of dollars a year going into Yellow Page advertising is simply for the
fact that they don't know it's not working anymore.
They don't know that it's not working, or they're too scared to change. What if my phone quits ringing? That's why they're spending. There's great marketplaces. I'm not knocking Home Advisor, Angie's List, or any of these. These are great
marketplaces. Though it's
they're expensive. For these guys, they're really, really expensive. I mean, those.
What does it cost to get a lead from Angie List in general?
So one of those. So this is the thing with leads. It's not like you're just buying a lead and you're going to get that customer. When you go, and Home Advisor, for example, an HVAC guy here in Utah is going to spend anywhere between $15 to $30 for a lead. The problem is that lead is going out to three or four other providers, and so you can actually do a test. Go out tonight and say, I want my windows clean. Go fill out an order form on Home Advisor at 10 o'clock at night, and you're probably going to get one of those guys calls you back within 3 or 4 minutes. And then tomorrow and the next day, you're going to get calls from the other two or three.
Right. And the guy that calls you back in a couple minutes, David Elkington would say, is the guy that's going to win.
He's most likely the guy that's going to win, and you're hoping that he's the guy that does a really good job. Really what we provide is a relationship that you've had with your window cleaner in the past, or your HVAC guy, or the person who cuts your hair, or the person who does your taxes. We're making that connection on an ongoing basis, so we're you don't have to go back out and remember who you used.
There's a couple ways to grow your business, right? One is to get new customers. The other is to make sure the customers you've already worked with that love you come back to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's really what you're helping folks
100%. And so, and you're right. I mean, these solutions exist out there, and if you want to kind of piece them together, they wouldn't be as affordable as what we can offer, just because we package it all together. But the solutions for that to kind of do it yourself, or they are out on the internet. I mean, you can buy them today.
So how much of your suite, because I know you're still growing, you're still early, how much of that suite, of that vision that you just described, is live now where somebody that runs a lawn care business could say, okay, I'm going to go to freshlime.com and start using these services?
So most of the pieces are functional. Obviously, they'll get better over time. But if the lawn care guy or the landscaper comes to us today, we can help him digitize his customer base and keep it in the palm of his hand on any mobile device. The scheduling tool, so we can implement the scheduling tool on his website, and he can run a schedule off of our system, sending out receipts, sending out all the reminders, helping them get reviews. All of those pieces are done. And then on the back end, we have really the marketing automation pieces saying, okay, now, Mr. Landscaper, you have these 5 holes in your schedule. We're going to go market to these customers. And that marketing piece we're doing on the back end, that's also there. I mean, there's other things that we're kind of working on, from better analytics and reporting, and really we're building a predictive analytics engine. So over time, we're going to take all of this transaction data, not only from your customers, but as a whole within verticals. And so we're going to know that reaching out to people to get their windows cleaned on Saturday afternoon when there's a football game goes on, it's a much better time than on a Wednesday afternoon when someone's at work. And so all that data will feed into our engine over time. And so that's when we say we're going to reach out to the customer when they're most likely to buy. It's taking all that data and putting it together, and so it'll be automated. So
you've just mentioned a couple really neat things on the predictive side. And you know, I've mentioned David Elkington's name a couple times. When he came in, he gave us all kinds of some really sound correlations. Like, if you can call back on an internet lead in 1 minute, that's better than calling back in 5 minutes, and that's better than calling back in an hour, and much better than a day. But some of the correlations did not make as much sense. Like, if you're in LA and you know, the you know, Chicago basketball team won last night, you're better off calling. Or there's some bizarre correlations that were predictive, and then that's part of it. But it took him years. I asked him, you know, where do you get the data for that? And when they first launched, they couldn't do it because they didn't have the data to crunch. Now they do. Where do you get your predictive data from?
So partly as we're collecting it. And so one of the unique things that we have, if we were a marketplace like Angie's List or HomeAdvisor or Thumbtack, we're going to be going out and trying to get consumers to come and use our product. What we've decided to do is we're focused on the merchant themselves. So when we go out and sign up a HVAC guy today or a landscaper or someone cutting hair, we're going to take and help them digitize their entire customer base. And so rather than going and trying to get consumers to use our product, we're taking consumers that are already existing within our customers, the Service Pros customer base. And so automatically every transaction, when they're going out and doing 5 appointments a day now, I'm getting all that transaction data. I don't have to go out and acquire the consumers. The consumers are automatically coming to us as a result.
So you have some predictive data now, but a year from now, you'll have even more.
Oh, yeah. We've really just started adding merchants to our platform in the last 45 days, yet we already have more than 50,000 consumer records within our database. By the end of 2015, we'll have more than 1.5 million. And so,
which brings me to a point. One of the things I like about what you're doing is the space is enormous.
It is.
I mean, what percent of the U.S. economy, you probably know this, is kind of a small business service provider? I'm guessing it's over 10% of the entire U.S. economy, probably closer to a third.
Yeah, there's almost $1 trillion worth of transactions that happen within these small business providers.
So I guess tie actually, because the U.S. economy is about 15 to 16
yeah.
trillion.
Yeah.
Healthcare is a huge piece of that. Food's a huge piece of that.
But it's
so
really
you guys are closer to 5 to 7% of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, but it's really something that affects all of us. I mean, any homeowner has had the frustration of waiting around for 4 hours for the service provider to show up. Or every service provider, 20 to 30% of their appointments don't show up. I mean, they're not there when they show up. And so there's billions of dollars.
Oh, don't get me wrong. If you can be the leader in a market that's 5 to 7% of the U.S. economy, you're going to be very, very happy.
Yeah, and really, I think for us, it's the convenience factor on both sides. I mean, we want service providers to be able to have a better relationship with consumers, and we want consumers not to have a negative. Like, I don't want to go to the dentist, and I don't want the plumber to come over either. But at the same time, if you can have a good relationship there, then there's that trust, and it's not a bad. It can be a good experience, and I think that's the thing that we can help these guys is we can create a good experience with service calls.
So the good news is it's 5 to 7% of the U.S. economy. Additional good news in some regard, in one aspect, is they really don't have a product like you're suggesting.
They don't.
Right? It's 2015. Al Gore invented the internet in 1993, I say in jest. And they're still not using a tool like this. That's the good news. The market's still available. The question is, why now? Why are they going to embrace a tool like this now when they haven't for the last 20 plus years?
That's a very good question, and I think it comes down to consumers are going to demand it. I mean, consumers want that convenience. As Americans, 98% of us have our phones within arm's reach 24/7, and we like the convenience factor of being able to push a button to buy and schedule things. We don't want to necessarily have to remember Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock to call the window cleaner because my wife reminded me on Saturday afternoon that I needed to call him. And I can't call him on Saturday. He's not working. And so it's really, I think, a convenience factor is really the thing that's going to push it forward. And the cost of leads for these guys continues to go up. And so a service provider that's been in business for 5 years has probably serviced 5,000 customers or 4,500 customers, yet very few of those customers are coming back on an ongoing basis. He's always going out and getting new customers. And so that local consumer is going from one provider to the next, and we like to deal with people that we know and trust. And so I think it's partly these guys are being forced into it. We have a younger generation of service providers that's coming up that will also be more willing to adopt these solutions. And for the
I hope it, and I suspect it will. I hope it works, because I think back a couple of years ago, my hot water heater broke. Right, huge problem for me. Right, flooded my basement. Now I've got an emergency. Fortunately, I have two, so you know the family wasn't without hot water. So I had time, and I made three phone calls. Right, the last guy that had serviced it put a sticker on, so he got a call, and I made two other calls. Turned out I went with somebody else. If he had called me 6 months before my water heater went out and said, "Hey, Doug, these things last three, four, 5 years." Let me come in and replace it before it breaks. I would have said, yeah, great idea. Thanks for calling. Yeah, come in and do it. I wouldn't have made two other phone calls. He would have kept the business, and I would have avoided having my basement flood and all of a sudden have something become an emergency. So I think you're on to a really big idea here. I hope the folks embrace it, because the time has come. The time has come.
And I think they've delayed, but it is, I don't know. If you see how these guys work today, I just created a video the other day, and we have customers who all their records are actually on paper. And so we have stacks of paper, and so we're scanning those, and we have data entry people digitizing customer bases for these guys.
And they're giving it to them with paper. They're not sending over their CRM file.
And that's a small percentage. It's probably 20% of customers so far that have sent over paper product. The rest of them have it in some digital format. But the time has come. I mean, they want that convenience factor for the most part. I mean, there's always going to be those that say, "Do you know I've done it this way for the last 50 years, and I'm too old. I'm not going to change now." And we'll give them that fact. But I think for the most part, people want to be more efficient. They want to be more efficient with their time. And they're just afraid of the marketing thing. They think of it from a marketing aspect, and they don't know what marketing works and what doesn't. We're the guys that can actually show them really at the end of the day, these leads are great for you. Here's your lifetime value of your customer. These customers are now coming back two or three or four times over a two-year period of time versus losing them to another provider. And so I think the time has come that we'll see this transition happen.
Let me wrap up with a couple questions outside of the three companies, and really just about your journey. So you've had two successful companies under your belt. Why do a third one? What is it about entrepreneurship that keeps you coming back?
I think it's around building. I mean, I like one of my old business partners, Chris Stevens, always said, I mean, you got to get up and go to work. You got to get up and do something every day, right? And so, but I like the aspect of starting with a clean piece of paper and saying, okay, this is a problem that needs to be solved, and we believe that we can do it. And so, so working with a team of people and bring people in that are passionate around helping small businesses is exciting to me. And so I think a lot of it has to do with actually building and seeing that you can help people be successful in their businesses. And at the same time, building a culture and an atmosphere of people who you like to work with, that you like to hang out with every day. And just like anything in life, I mean, I think we like to accomplish things. And as an entrepreneur, I know I'm a better entrepreneur than I probably am an employee. But I'm the first guy. I mean, you'll see me. I don't care if I take out the trash. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's nothing kind of. I mean, I think you have to be willing to do anything within the business. And so, if that's spending the night packing envelopes or whatever the case might be, it's just part of being a team.
Yeah, especially early on, right?
I mean, absolutely,
you've got to do it all. And if you're thinking about becoming an entrepreneur because you want to be the boss, it's probably a lot easier ways to go about doing that than being an entrepreneur. You know, we were talking before we hit the record button in the studio here about, you know, the value of your previous entrepreneurial experiences. When you left Mindshare to start aha.com, what did you think would be the toughest part of being an entrepreneur? And as you think about that question now that you're on your third company, actually fourth if we count Sunglasses only in that list, what's your view of that now? What do you think the toughest part of being an entrepreneur is, and what skill set have you developed during this journey that you're glad you have today that you might not have had in 99?
Wow, that's a big question. I think in 99, 98, end of 98, when I was really kind of leaving to start my own thing, I didn't really think about being an entrepreneur. I mean, I really wanted to create and work for a business where we truly valued our employees. And so it was a lot about kind of the opportunity, but I didn't really kind of think about entrepreneurship. And I probably didn't really think of myself as an entrepreneur until probably after I started Orange Soda. But I think along the way, I mean, before we started talking, I said, it's really, we all pay tuition along the way. And my tuition may be, having to lay people off or learning a new skill or at AHA, I didn't have a network. I didn't know the value of actually hanging out with other business owners and kind of using and utilizing those networks. And I really found with Orange Soda, especially when we started raising money, having a little bit of a network that you could trust and people to recommend you to talk to someone else.
It's huge.
Absolutely huge. And I think I didn't understand that at all when I started. It was all hard rock mining at AHA. I didn't have a network. I was just a kid. And
let's talk about that, right? Because most folks that do start entrepreneurship, it's earlier in their career. They don't have as developed of a network. If you don't have that network, how can you tap into a network?
I think it's probably a lot easier today than it was 15 years ago. I mean, because of LinkedIn, because of the kind of startup community and all the networking events that are going on. And maybe some of those existed back in 1999. I don't know if they did. I mean, I know like LinkedIn didn't, but I mean, as far as kind of Chamber of Commerce or other things, I mean, there's probably some ways I could have networked with local business owners a little bit more.
You know, what I'd add to that is when you bring on investors, that's one of the key things hopefully they can help you with, right? I mean, your investors, yeah, they have money, and sometimes you just need money and you take money from whoever you can get it from. But if you're fortunate enough to have a choice between investors, you know, you want somebody that has a Rolodex and just as important is willing to use it. Another thing is you don't, as a early entrepreneur, you don't have a lot of execution experience. You want somebody that can coach you and help you with that. And then the third one would be content knowledge. You know, if they're an industry expert, great. They don't have to have the other two. But I would say if you have your choice, you probably want somebody that brings two of those three aspects to the table, either industry knowledge, they can coach you on some of the executional challenges you're going to have, or they have a Rolodex and they're willing to use it.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100% there. I think one thing that I would caution is don't, also as an entrepreneur, don't abuse those relationships. Don't ask too much. And if you're out there trying to build a business, if you reach out to other people and have them help you, but also don't abuse that. I mean, just don't expect that someone's going to every day make 10 more introductions for you. It's just not going to happen.
It'll happen once and it'll shut off.
Yeah,
you know,
at least
choose when you ask for help wisely.
Yeah, at least give something back. Be willing to kind of, it needs to be a two-way street. I think going back and looking at, if I would have known some of those things in the early days, the one thing I did do is try to work with people that are a lot smarter than I am. And I think that we have to understand that nobody knows everything. You don't have all the answers. And so I think being truly part of a team, listening, and I've had to learn this over the years. I mean, listening to my team members and trusting that they're going to do their piece of the pie.
It's hard sometimes
giving up control, but you need to know what you're good at. And really, I learned that during kind of my years at Orange Soda is I know what I'm really good at and I know what I'm not good at. And so I'm not trying to, I'll never try to do some of those things that I would have done before because it's not what I'm good at. And so I think trying to understand that early on, saying, okay, I don't have to have all the knowledge, and I can trust other people and trust that they're going to do their piece, and that's what builds that great culture as well.
Well, Jay, that's a great note for us to end on. You've obviously learned a lot of hard fought for lessons during your journey. Our guest this morning has been Jay Bean, the founder and CEO of Aha.com, Orange Soda, and now FreshLime.com. Jay, thanks for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Hey, thank you.
Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Jay on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.